And you probably saw the first homework is up. We haven't really talked about the stuff yet. You need to know it, so don't worry about it. I just went ahead and put it up over the weekend so that you can see there, and it's not due for a while.
Where you post that at?
On the class syllabus. Oh, so okay. If you go to the bayreed.com, CSC 533, there's a link to it. And it's not due until next, what is that?
31st.
31st is next Thursday. Monday, Wednesday, yes. And really the idea is we're going to cover probably most of what you need to do to do it today, and certainly by Wednesday we will. But this is, there's no programming, this is all just doing things on paper. It really should not take that much time. So I'm giving you a week and a day just to make sure. But I don't think you're gonna find, it's not like a programming assignment where you could sink a lot of hours into it. What it does mean is that if you're spending a lot of time on it, there's probably stuff that you're not quite understanding, so you want to come get help on it. So don't wait until the last minute, because it is new, it's a new kind of thing. But if you're getting it, I don't think you're going to find it that long to deal with. We'll talk about what it is. Here we go. So this is only our second meeting. It seems like the semester's been like 3 weeks old, doesn't it? We've been doing this a long time. Are there any questions about the syllabus, the course, how it's running, all that kind of stuff? You got a chance to cogitate? Okay, good weekend? Cold? I'm sorry, I'm going to be tired today because I got sucked into staying up last night watching the Serena Williams match. Wasn't over till 4 o'clock.
Oh my gosh.
I'm trying to stop that habit, but the Australian Open's killing me because all the best matches are in the middle of the night. It's a great match.
Do you play tennis?
I did before my knees gave out, and my son is into tennis. So it's fun to watch. I guess the NFL games are exciting, and I don't really watch NFL. Duke looked really good.
They're in a closer time zone, though.
That is true. That is true. Did Creighton women win yesterday? That's a sad thing. Have you seen the good movies? Has anybody seen Glass yet?
No.
Is it good? I haven't seen it.
Spider-Verse was good.
Okay. Nice.
So. I did see the Green Book.
The Green Book?
Yeah. It's about in the 60s, the African-American piano player that goes on a tour in the South, and there's a white kind of bigoted guy that's his driver, and it's really interesting. It's got a lot of Oscar buzz.
Wow.
It's pretty good. So do you guys ever go to movies like at the Sokolov Theater, the film streams?
Mm-hmm.
That's such a cool place to go.
Mm-hmm.
Not very comfortable. But
yeah.
In fact, the film streams for students, Mondays you go for free. Show ID, you get to go to movie for free.
Yeah, the first Monday of the month.
Oh, it's not every Monday?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's too bad. Still, free is good, even if it's only once a month.
Yeah.
Okay. You guys aren't very chatty. Still in shock over the start of the semester.
Maybe maybe people were disappointed that the Chiefs lost.
All the talk is now have to change the overtime rules because of how bad it was. All right, well, let's get going. Let me start back here. So what I'm going to do this week is, first of all, a little bit of background on programming languages, just sort of to make sure some of the terminology is there. And then the other thing is we're going to get sort of into the nuts and bolts of languages pretty deep, and then we're going to go into functional language or whatever. And one thing I found when I taught this course, I've taught this course a long time. I've been doing this, I think there's only like two semesters since I've been here in my now 19 years, or 20? Would it be 20? So I'm teaching in 2019, I came in 2000. So maybe 8 or 9, 2019 or 20. When I started doing it, I found that one of the things I was missing is sort of a historical perspective. So what I want to do is just sort of tell you some of the main languages out there so that if you go out and you're in a job interview or something like that and somebody says, yeah, I first learned to program in COBOL, and you're like, I have no idea what that is. There's some languages you should at least know what they are and what they were good for and things. And then what we're going to do sort of at the end of today and next time is talk about syntax. So if we're going to get into the real details of how languages work and what they are, one of the things we need to be able to do is to very clearly, unambiguously be able to say, this is what an if statement looks like. This is what a for loop. This is a correct version of this. This one is incorrect. And for the most part, when you learn a language, the language details are given to you by examples. So it says, here's the general format of what a for loop looks like in Java, and here's a whole bunch of examples of it. But you don't really know all the details. And usually for most programmers, you can get it all from English text. But English text is very ambiguous, and you end up having to say the same thing over and over again just to make sure somebody understands it, like I just did with that paragraph, and to do things. But if you're really going to be a serious programmer, or you're ever going to develop a programming language, you're going to write a compiler for a particular machine or something like that, you got to know exactly on things. And a good story of this, I used to be the chief reader for AP Computer Science. So I was the guy in charge of grading all the AP exams. And this occurred back when the exam was in C++. But it kind of applies with Java, because a lot of the same rules apply with Java. So in C++, you declare a variable kind of the same way you do in Java, into X. You can declare and initialize at the same time, just like in Java. And so I could say int X is equal to 0. And then the other thing, just like in Java, you can have multiple declarations on the same line. So I can say int x equals 0, y is equal to 5. And it declares two different integer variables, x, which assigns to be 0, and y, which assigns to be 5. Okay? You can do that in Java, too. Now, here's a question for you. Can I do that? I challenge you to find any, well, at the time it was C++, but any Java textbook that will give you the answer to this. I've never found one. Because we just sort of describe things, this is a declaration and an initialization. Does the declaration initialization of X end at the comma, or does it end at the semicolon? So is it to declare this one first, initialize it, now x is 0, and then I can assign y to be x? Or do they both get declared initialized together when the statement is done? Nobody will tell you that, because nobody thinks about this kind of detail. And so if it's just, here's examples of how you use it, whatever, it never comes up. And this happened on an exam. Someone did this on an exam, and it got me. It didn't really matter, and we accepted it on the exam. But it just got me like really concerned, and I was doing. The only way I found the answer to this in C++ was by finding the syntax rules for the language that essentially said the declaration ends at the semicolon. But I had to go through, we're going to talk about the BNF, the rules for what are the syntax of the language. That was the only way to get the answer to this. Now someone said, At the time, it's like, well, let's try it. Let's just run it and see what happens. Is that really an answer?
It's a programmer's answer.
It's in some ways it's a practical answer that if you're using this compiler, but all it really tells me is that the person who wrote that compiler interpreted it that way. That doesn't necessarily mean that every compiler writer is going to do it that way. And especially, you know, at the time, C++ was open, so anybody could write a compiler for it. And so that's not real. I mean, it some way tells you to work on my machine, but I don't know it's going to work on your machine if you're using a different compiler on things. Yeah, Parker.
So can you do that?
Yes, you can. So the declaration actually, this is actually two different declarations. It's not a single declaration statement. It's a single statement, but it contains two declarations. It's kind of a weird thing. Okay. So sometimes you've got to have black and white, yes or no, no ambiguity definitions of things. And there's going to be a fairly simple way of doing that in terms of syntax. There's not a very clear way of doing that. I'm going to actually cop out on you guys. We're going to spend a lot of time talking about how to get syntax really correctly. And again, syntax is the format of the language. What does a for loop look like? The semantics, what does it mean? There are a number of ways people have tried to formally define semantics. It is really, really hard. And so really it comes down to, we go back to English and lots of examples and things like that. So we just describe how things are and we hope that we say it enough ways that everyone understands it the same way. But at least syntax, we can get a lot of things locked down. And in a case like this, where you say, look, you can only, when you do an assignment, the right-hand side has to already be declared, initialized, and then I found a thing saying the declaration initialization ends at the comma, I can figure out what the right answer is. So, but let's do, first of all, a little background. Machine language, assembly language, high-level language, those terms familiar? Okay. And again, just to remind you, when programming first started, when you could program computers, you programmed it in machine language, which was binary digits that represented actual physical actions within the computer. So this series of zeros and ones tell the computer to flip this switch this way and to have this bus connected to this one and send information, route information through the CPU and all these different things. Horrible, horrible, horrible thing. This is an actual machine language program. Pretty clear to see what it does, right? You can figure that out. If I told you it didn't work, how would you fix it? Holy moly. I mean, how would you know that, okay, that one really should be a zero, obviously. I mean, it was horrible to code in this. Anybody done machine language? No, you guys never had to back in whatever. It was just horrible. I mean, and in fact, again, you have to remember, one of the things when we talk about languages and things, and you look back at the history, you're like, why would anybody ever do this? Well, the alternative was, this was the first way you could program. Before then, computers had to be wired to perform certain tasks. So some of the early computers, think of ENIAC as the first electronic computer. ENIAC was hardwired to do a set of computations. You could provide inputs to it by turning dials and things like that, but they used it for generating ballistics tables. So you'd put in inputs of, you want a target that's this distance away and the wind is coming from this angle and all this kind of stuff. How far do you, how what angle do you put the rocket or the mortar that you're sending? Once they built all those tables and they wanted to do something else, they had to rewire the machine. So they just got somebody in there and pull out wires and put this one here and essentially build a new computer to do a new task. If that's your choice, maybe this isn't so bad. Mm-hmm. So this was certainly an improvement over physically building a new machine to do something different. And so, you know, they thought, wow, this was great. What a great thing to do. I mean, just remember, years from now, people are going to look back and say, well, you had to program by, like, actually typing in letters on a screen, and you had to use this language that was weird, and it, like, if you misspelled something, it wouldn't work. It's like, how horrible was that? How could anybody work like that? Well, that's the best we have. So machine language was certainly an improvement. It was the first way of being able to make the same machine do multiple things, but incredibly tedious, error-prone. It's just digit bits for doing different things that didn't really mean anything. And one of the real drawbacks is machine specific. So every different computer type had its own machine language because it had a different hardware inside of it. And so if you learned to program on this particular machine and you wrote software for it, and then you wanted to use that software on a different machine, forget it. It wouldn't work. It was a completely different language. So you couldn't have a software industry. You couldn't really develop software and market it broadly, because if you wrote that piece of software that worked on an IBM 704, you could only sell it to people using IBM 704s. And that was it. So that was a difficult way of doing things.
How would people actually enter in this information, though? Would they? What was the process of? What was the input? What was the output?
I mean, in the 40s and 50s, when these were there, there were different things. There were like tapes, so like tapes you would punch holes into, and then it would feed through. Eventually, there were punch cards that you could do things with. There were magnetic tapes that you could do. So there were sort of different technologies for doing it, but not great. I mean, you weren't typing in zeros and ones on the screen, at least at that time.
Right.
Pretty horrible. So it didn't take very long. So after these came out in the late 40s, early 50s, by the early 50s, assembly languages were added on. And assembly languages, again, were still machine-specific. So each different type of machine had its own assembly language. What it really was intermediate code, that you would write something that looked more like this. This is actually assembly for Unix. Actually, it's really old, Unix, C++ program. But you could substitute words for bit patterns. So instead of having to remember 0110001, you could write the word add or move. And those kind of made some sense. So here what I'm doing is moving something from one address to another address in memory. A little bit easier to understand. The other thing, in addition to adding words to it, it gave you essentially variables. So you could say, I want to be able to, let's call this value X, and then let's refer to X over there. In machine code, you had to actually know the physical address for something. So you would say, okay, this is in memory location 473. And if you ever wanted to insert something into the code, everything's address got messed up, and it was really ugly on things. So it gave you relative addressing, and it gave you words instead of numbers. And that was a big improvement. It didn't really change anything that it could do, because when you would write an assembly language program, what you would do is feed it to another program that would take this stuff and just convert it all back to zeros and ones. So these were not executable on the computer. You still ran things in machine code, but you sort of wrote this in human language. This is not really human language, but it's a little more human. And then it would get translated back to the machine level and then executed. Do you guys do a little assembly in 414? Organization?
We discussed it.
Okay.
Yeah, but maybe physically.
You didn't have to write it?
Yeah.
That's too bad. Have to do that. It's like a rite of passage. It was horrible. I mean, it's not like you want to do it. It's still horrible to deal with. In fact, my first teaching after I, well, no, it wasn't first because I taught for a year. But my first course I taught at Duke as I was visiting faculty, I got dumped the assembly language programming class, and I didn't know what I was doing. It was a horrible experience. Mm. It was one of those horrible things as a teacher. If you ever go into teaching, it's a horrible thing when you're a week ahead of the students, mm-hmm. and you don't know, you're just okay, I just, please don't ask me any questions, because what I put up there is the only thing I know about this topic. That's a horrible situation. But I got through it. So assembly was certainly an improvement, but not really that great. It wasn't really until high-level languages came along that programming became easier for people. And the whole idea with a high-level language is that you can write it, and there's a zillion of them that are out there now, Java, Python, whatever, but they're much more the way humans think. And you can argue whether they're really the way you think, if they're really natural, but compared to assembly and machine, come on, they're a lot better. And so a high-level language allows you to program at a higher level of abstraction, which is why it's called high-level language. Interestingly enough, I don't know if you sort of thought about this before, computers haven't gotten any smarter than they did back in the 40s. They still run on machine language. But what we've done is sort of created these high-level languages, and then we still have to do what we did with assembly, is to translate them down to the machine language for that machine. So what we're kind of doing is getting sort of farther and farther away. At one end of the spectrum, you've got your computer. Ooh, there's a computer there. What was that, computer, right? Over here, you've got the programmer, right? Machine language is sort of the language of the computer down here. A high-level language is over here. Assembly is sort of somewhere here. It's much closer to the machine language on types of things. But what ends up happening is that whether it's an assembly language, whether it's a high-level language, let's say it's Java over here, you've still got to get it translated down to the level the computer understands. And the two ways that's typically done with a high-level language is either with a compiler or an interpreter. So an interpreter, Python uses an interpreter. When you give it code to execute, it actually takes one instruction at a time, says, okay, what does this mean when you say x is equal to 5? Okay, then I need to go into my table in memory and put an entry in for x and put a 5 there. Okay, I did what you wanted to do. Next thing is print. Oh, okay, what do I do when I print? I go and I get the value of x from here. I display it on the screen. So an interpreter reads one line at a time, executes it, reads the next line, executes it, reads the next line, executes it. And how does it execute it? Well, it actually does the machine language instruction or multiple instructions or whatever to carry that out. Okay. A compiler, on the other hand, converts the entire thing into machine instructions. So you give it a Java program, it will compile it down to, actually, I'm going to take Java, I'm going to do C++, because Java is a weird one. You do a C++ program, you give it the source code that's in a .cpp file or .cc file, and it produces a .exe file. So a machine language program that then you can run over and over again. So a compiler is the equivalent of what an assembler was. You give it a high-level language as input, it gives you back machine language file as output. And again, sort of the corresponding things to this, when you translate a book from one language to another, you hand it off to somebody, a month later they come back with a translation, or many months later, that's a compiler. You do it all at once. Once you've compiled it, then you can read it in a book. You can read it as many times as you want to. With a program, you can execute it as many times as you want to, and it's really fast because it's already in machine code. When you interpret it, you get immediate results. You get the first instruction executed, the second instruction executed, the third instruction executed. It's very immediate. But every time you execute it, you have to re-translate it. And so it's you get quicker feedback, but the overall execution is slower because it has to redo that work every time. Okay. What is Java? I'll look at the screen. Java's weird. Java is both. So Java, it's mostly compiled. Most of the work is done with a compiler. So when you compile your Java code, your .java file, it creates a .byte? No, I'm
jar?
Blanking here.
What's the jar file?
The .java to the .... Wow. Well, Teresa's byte code, but .class, right? Yeah, no wonder it didn't make sense. So Java produces something called Java bytecode. And so if you ever look in, like, if you're doing NetBeans or something like that, when you compile, there's the source folder that has all the source files in it. And then it has another folder over there where it has all the .class files. And I always have trouble when I teach Java classes. Like the first assignment when I do Dropbox, somebody will give me all the .class files, which I can actually run. You can run them, but you can't look at the source code because what the Java compiler does, it takes that .java file and it converts it into machine code, which is this Java bytecode. But what's weird about it is it doesn't produce machine code for your particular machine. If you're running on a Mac that's running these chips and whatever, it doesn't actually produce the machine language for that machine. It produces something called Java bytecode for something called the Java virtual machine. It's not a real machine. It's a generic machine that all things do. So no matter what computer you're on, if you compile your Java source code, it produces Java bytecode, which is exactly the same. Okay. Then there has to be an interpreter for your particular machine that interprets the Java bytecode and runs it on your machine. Now that seems like a very weird thing, because the advantage of compiling, it takes a long time to compile, but then you can run it really fast. The advantage of interpreters is that you get immediate feedback, but it's kind of slow in the long run. And so if you compile and interpret, you would seem like you get the worst of those. You're not going to get the speed, you're not going to get the speed of every time you run it when you compile it, because you still have to interpret it. And you're not going to get the immediacy of an interpreter, because you have to go through all that work of compiling up front. It's a very weird thing. I remember when this first came out, I'm like, this makes no sense at all. But in fact, what ends up happening is, because the Java virtual machine is so close, it's just this generic machine language, it's really close to every machine language out there. It's not like computers have really different architectures to them. So their machine instructions are pretty similar. So what ends up happening is, when you compile it into the Java virtual code, it interprets really fast. I mean, generally there's like a one-to-one correspondence between Java bytecode instruction and your machine code instruction. So the interpreter is almost transparent. The advantage is that when you compile into Java bytecode, you can take those .class files and put it on any machine and run it. And so it means that you get, for in terms of software development, if I want to develop this software and I want to sell it to you, I don't have to give you the source code. I can just give you the .class files. And then you can run it on any machine you want. You don't have to buy the Mac version or the Windows version or whatever. I just give you the .class files. You run it on your Java interpreter. And so I don't have to develop multiple versions, but I also have some control over the source code, which is a good thing. So it's a weird, kind of a weird hybrid that works. This is actually the same program as on those previous two slides. So this is a C++ program that was compiled down into assembly code, compiled into assembly code and into machine code. You probably don't know C++, but I bet you can guess what that does. What does it do?
Prints hello world.
Prints hello world. Exciting. You probably should have guessed that on those other ones, right? I mean, what's the first program you're going to see anywhere? It's hello world. And so this, certainly a lot more understandable than the other two. Assembly was better than machine. I mean, you could look at the assembly, and maybe if you had a manual, you could figure it out in a little bit. Forget that machine code about disaster. Mm.
So can you compile a C++ code into the assembly code? Is that how you did it?
Yeah, there was an option. This was, I did this, actually, that code is predates me coming to Creighton in 2000. But that was on a Unix system, and in the C++ compiler, you have a lot of sort of command line flags you can do, and one is generate the assembly code for it, so you can see it if you want to. Normally you don't. I mean, you don't see the intermediate step, but you can if you want to. Certainly one thing to sort of keep in mind as we're learning about different languages and the features that developed or whatever is that as languages were starting to evolve, people didn't really know how to program, and that had to evolve as well. So what is the approach to writing programs? When the first languages came out, it's like people did it and sort of best practices sort of came out of it as you went. It wasn't really until about the 1970s that people started really paying attention to how do you develop software. And in fact, those of you, so Vicky and David, who are in the capstone, we read some papers that were by Fred Brooks, who was one of the pioneers of software engineering, where they were developing the first big software projects. You were in Capstone, yeah. And the stuff they had to figure out, because just nobody had really paid much attention to it before. And part of that is that before the 1970s, the cost of the hardware was so much more than the cost of software and the cost of the programmers. That you could afford to pay people money and have them really become specialists and develop the expertise, because there weren't that many programmers and the machine cost was so high that whatever. But as machines got cheaper, all of a sudden the cost of programmers became more significant, more relatively higher. And so what you wanted to do was to be able to sort of maximize that resource. How do you make programmers more efficient? How do you make it to where, you know, I don't have to redevelop the same software over and over again, you know, once I've invested the time to do it? And so in the 1970s is when sort of the approach that developed out of this was the idea of top-down design. And this was a very sort of procedural way of looking at software, where you would basically say, all right, I've got a problem to do. I'm going to be doing payroll, or I'm going to be doing something. What are the main sort of steps in that? That, you know, okay, there's three main tasks that I have to do. And so let me think about this project as, at the top level, I've got payroll I have to do. Okay, and then there are three main subtasks to that. And one of them is to, you know, get the HR records. The other one is to calculate, you know, the time that a person, the hours that someone had or whatever. And then the last one is to generate the checks. I don't know. Something we have to do. So you sort of divide a big project into smaller subtasks. And then you keep doing that. You say, okay, well, getting on the HR information, how much? Well, that actually is going to end up being several tasks as well. Calculating, I got to do this. If you're salaried versus if you're hourly, you break it down, and eventually you get down to subtasks that are small enough that's like, oh, I could write a function to do that, or I could write a little piece of code to do that. And so you would organize a project by this sort of top-down, break it into tasks, break those into subtasks, break those into subtasks. And then you could also sort of do these, I can remember doing these, where you'd also then sort of annotate with what information goes from where to where. So when I call this one, I'm going to pass this information to it, and then it's going to return this value. I'm going to pass this information down, I'm going to return these values up. And this was how you started organizing how you would do a big project. Okay. And it had good advantages. It made you sort of think through how things were going to work. It made it possible to say, okay, your team does this module, your team does this module, your team does this module. So it sort of opened up sort of team programming and stuff. And it was a pretty successful sort of first attempt at how do you organize big pieces of software and things. Sort of an addendum to that, in the late 70s, once memory started getting a little bit cheaper and you could start storing more and more information on your computer, a little bit more data-oriented approach developed. And that was really the idea of, okay, great, I can sort of think about the tasks, the sort of the functionality in this way. But I also need to think about what information am I going to have to store, how am I going to access it. And so languages started giving you a much better support for being able to create your own types. So the term I'm going to throw at you a lot, abstract data type, which is basically just saying, when you talk about a type in a language, you're talking not only about the data it represents, but what actions you're allowed to do on it. So if you said, I've created a language and it has an integer type, so you can represent 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, but it doesn't have addition. You'd say, that's really not an integer if you can't do that. So, you know, we think about things like in Java, the types we deal with, they're abstract data types. A map is a two-dimensional structure, and you need to be able to look up a value based on the key, you need to be able to store a value based on the key, you need to be able to get a list of all the keys, get a list of all the values. Those are the actions you want to be able to perform on a map. And so the data there plus the actions you want to do really defines that abstract data type. Okay, it's now what we think of as classes, is how we're going to implement them in modern times. So languages really started focusing on data-oriented programming, giving you the ability to create your own data types and use them. And that started sort of changing the way people thought about programming, because it was much more about, okay, what's the data that I need and how am I going to manipulate it, versus sort of this put everything in boxes sort of thing. And all of a sudden you're thinking now about, well, this information has to go from here to here and to here. Well, who owns it? Can I make it to where it's owned here and these can access it? It was a little bit different way of thinking about things. And then in the 1980s is when sort of that movement of data turned into object-oriented programming. So the idea that, okay, if we're going to have these abstract data types where you've got data and operations, let's wrap those up into these nice little packages we'll call classes. And then you can create objects out of those classes. And then you can have inheritance, and you can have interfaces, the kind of things we're used to, so that we can really leverage existing types and be able to create new types from them and create sort of generic types so that I can have a list of bank accounts that could be checking accounts or savings accounts or whatever. And so object orientation came around in the early 1980s and is still sort of the dominant approach to large-scale software engineering type things. So languages now, there's a lot of different types of languages, but even languages that aren't object-oriented nowadays, something like Python has support for object-oriented because it's such a natural way of thinking about things. So in Python, for example, you use objects a lot. Strings are objects. Lists are objects that have methods and data fields associated with them. Just Python's not very good at writing objects, writing your own classes. You can, but yeah, they're ugly. So languages have evolved sort of based on the approach that we look at things. And then when you start looking about large-scale development, there have been sort of software engineering practices or processes that have evolved as well. So you guys ever ran across the waterfall method? The waterfall method was the approach when you're designing and testing a big software system where you would have a series of steps you would do, where you would say, I want to get the specifications, and then I'm going to do from there the design, and then I'm going to do analysis of that design to make sure it looks good. And then I'm going to code, and then I'm going to test. And you'd have these steps involved. And so you plan everything out, and you say, OK, I'll do this phase, and once it's done, I'll go to this phase and this phase. And it's sort of like a waterfall as you go down the process until eventually you get down to the end and everything works. It's wonderful in theory. It doesn't work very well in theory. For one thing, the water tends to keep jumping back up again when you realize as I'm coding this that, boy, that was a horrible design. Or when I'm testing it, I'm realizing I didn't think about this. I'm going to have to go back and do it. So there's all these sort of outlets where the water has to run uphill and then come back down again. But it also really is kind of not that practical because it requires you to sort of think out everything and do everything in stages. So you do all the design, and you don't actually code anything until it's all designed. And then you code it all, and then you don't do any testing until you're done coding. That's just not, doesn't make sense. It was fine when programs were fairly small, when you didn't have many people working on it. You could envision the entire thing in your head. It doesn't work very well on big projects anymore. And so there were different things that sort of came out of that. In the 1990s, there was something called extreme programming. Anybody remember? This was before your time. Whatever. Extreme. Extreme was like big in the 90s. It was like everything was X. So that's when the X games came out and everything. You know, Mountain Dew was extreme. And everything. It was like the cool thing. You know, skateboarding and all this stuff. Extreme this. Extreme that. And so they called it extreme programming. And the name just flopped.
I still hear about XP sometimes. Not Windows, but extreme programming.
Yeah.
Because Kent Beck is still around and active. And he was a big guy in that.
Well, I mean, it's still around. We don't call it that anymore.
Right.
So what they found was that extreme programming, extreme is great when you're trying to sell, surfboards to young kids or whatever like that, or Mountain Dew, or what was that? There was that SUV. What was it? The Xterra. Right. Is that still around? There was like this thing that they're trying to sell it to young people. The Xterra, whatever. It's like, ooh, X, extreme. Extreme is not what software managers want their software to be. It's not what IBM doesn't want extreme code. They don't want anything extreme. They want stable. They want everything that works. So the name evolved into Agile, because who doesn't want to be Agile, right? I mean, what company does, yeah, we're Agile. We're extreme. No, we're not extreme. That's scary. So Agile programming is the term we use for it now. And there's a lot of sort of religions within Agile programming, where you're doing Scrum or you're doing different things. But Agile programming is sort of the modern large software process that we use, which is you've got sort of all these steps here, but what you want to do is sort of integrate them. You want to be able to say, let's do a large scale, high level design. How's this thing going to work in the broad sense? Well, let's not figure out all the details. So we know we have a plan. And then let's start building prototypes. Let's have short-term goals that by this date, and there's different ones, you know, I think in Scrum is it every 30 days you have a checkpoint, you have some deliverable, something like that. And so you're basically going to say, okay, well, we're not going to develop the whole thing. Let's have, what's the really core functionality? So what is the basic thing? Let's just sort of get something working quickly. And then have that working. Okay, we got that. Now the next goal is going to be, let's add this functionality to it. Let's do this. And so you have short-term goals, which is tends to be much more productive. They're much more effective working with customers, because the bad thing you want to do with waterfall is you say, okay, well, this is going to take 2 years to develop. And so your customer pays you for it, and then you go off, and 2 years later you come back with the software, at which point their entire business model has changed, and everything, other the things they need are different, and whatever. And so with Agile, you can sort of create the prototype and go to the customer and say, does this look okay? Is it good so far? Anything different? Anything you want us to change? And they'll say, yeah, I don't like the way that works. And oh, by the way, we have this new feature we want you to add. And so you can sort of adapt. This is where the agility comes from, is that you can sort of move and change if you need to. And yet you still sort of are working on a trajectory towards the big thing. Okay. In fact, this is something I know last, I taught 221 last semester, and I actually brought Agile into some of the assignments, because I found that people were waterfalling it. They were trying to design the entire thing and then code the entire thing. And that's just not, even at the level you're learning intro Python, what you want to do first of all is say, okay, let's not deal with the special cases. Let's just get, can I read from the file and print out the words I read? Okay, let's make sure I can get that going. Okay, now that I can read them in, can I store them in the right data structure to be able to do what I want? So do it, print out the data structure, yes, it works. Okay, now can I go through and access and do what I need to do? And that's a really good way of thinking about things, even as you're programming for courses, is, you know, you want something working as quickly as possible. Now you want to think, you want to have that plan in mind so that you're not coding something and then have to throw half of it away. But, you know, okay, I realize I'm going to have to be able to, you know, read from a file and or prompt the user in a loop and say, do you, how many times do you want to play the game? Just get that stuff working, then get the details, get the, like one thing I tend to think of is when I write code, usually error, checking errors is the last thing that I do. So I'm going to say, okay, I'm going to first of all write this as if no bad things ever happen. So the user always enters exactly what they're supposed to enter. The file is always there. It always contains the right data, everything. Let's get it to work on that. Now I'll go back and do the error checking kind of stuff. So focus on sort of getting something working, adding, till you get to the end. It works well in business because you want to go back to the customer. It works well in a class because you want something that works when the assignment's done. Especially in my classes where I've got my 25% rule. If you're late, there's a 25% penalty on it. You want something working so when the due date comes, you can say, okay, it's working. I didn't get this last feature done, but that feature's only going to be worth like 10%. I should turn it in as opposed to taking the penalty on stuff. So you don't want to have, you know, oh, it's the deadline's due. I've got 100% of it working 90%. That is not a good thing. You want 90% of it working 100%. And then you can decide what you do with it. Now, another aspect that I mentioned on the first day, this idea there's different sort of families, different approaches to programming. And everything you've seen this so far really fits under this model, which is the imperative languages. So the languages that are based on assigning values to variables and having control statements that either say, if this is true, I'll do this assignment, else do this assignment, or repeatedly do this assignment, or whatever. And imperative languages really are modeling what's going on physically inside of the computer. So again, if you think back to way back in 121, if you took 121, where we talked about sort of what's the architecture of computers and the von Neumann architecture, the idea that every sort of modern computer fits under this umbrella of having three main logical components. You've got the CPU, which does all the calculations and everything. You've got memory, which is storing both the data you want to manipulate and the programs for manipulating that data. And then you have input-output devices that allow the person to communicate, say, oh, this is the command I want executed, or this is the program I want executed, see the results on a screen. And then information is moving back and forth from input-output getting stored in memory, from memory getting used in the CPU, from the CPU getting put back in memory or coming back out again. And if you think about what happens in an imperative language, a language like Java, when you get down to the basic stuff here, every variable is basically corresponding to a memory location. So there's some data structure that's storing, variable X is stored in memory here. Every time you do an assignment, you're just putting a value in that table with the value of X. So you're saying, oh, there's this table, think of it as a map. The key is X, the value is now 5. Every time you do an assignment, it's changing the state of that computer. And then all of the ifs and whiles and whatever are just this big sort of loops or conditionals. It's basically what the CPU is doing. It's constantly just saying, what do? I get the next instruction. I have to fetch this information from memory. I execute it. I go get the next instruction. This kind of stuff. It really sort of matches what you're doing when you write a Java method or when you write a Python piece of code or whatever. And so when it comes down to it, imperative languages tend to be very fast because when you have to do this step, I just erased it here, but when I write this program in Python and I want to be able to execute it over here, that x equals 5 probably corresponds to a single machine language instruction, which is store this value in this memory location. And things like ifs have built-in hardware, built-in machine instructions that do those things because that's what computers do. They store values, they update values, they compare values and do this operation or do that operation. The underlying machine instructions are basically the same logical instructions that imperative languages do over and over and over again. So the translation is not that hard. So if I had my picture here as well, imperative languages are much farther to the left because it's not that much work to translate them from Python into machine language or from C into machine language or whatever. Again, there are going to be other kinds of languages, and we're going to look at functional programming. Functional and logic programming language in particular are two that are called declarative languages because they're not about saying, do this, do this, do this, do this, do this. They're really about sort of describing at a higher language, this is what I want. So in a functional language, it's, okay, start with this piece of data, transform it this way, and then take the result of that and transform it this way, and then transform that and transform this, and at the end, you've sort of turned the thing that started out as this into something new, something that you want. In a logic programming language, it's about saying, here are the logical characteristics I want the answer to be. Make it happen. These are things that don't have very nice one-to-one correlations from an instruction in Scheme or instruction in Prolog to a machine instruction for that particular machine. And so typically, when you look at a Scheme instruction, for example, where it might be a one-to-one correlation from C to machine instruction, it might take 5, it might take 10 machine instructions to do that same task that the single Scheme instruction did. Okay? Now, the good thing is that tends to mean that it's a higher level of abstraction, so it's closer to the way we think about things. But it means it's a lot more work to get that one really high-level instruction down to something that gets executed by the computer. So declarative languages tend to be sort of farther on the right. They're closer to the way we think. Correspondingly, there's a much greater distance when you have to compile or interpret them. And so they tend to be slower. Now, slow is a relative term. I mean, with the speed of computers today, even a slow language is really fast. When we do Scheme, it's not like you're going to be sitting there waiting for it to do, to add 10 numbers together. It still could do things really fast. But if you're doing, heavy computation, if you're going to be doing graphics, you're not writing graphics programs in Python. Python's kind of slow, it's interpreted there. You're not going to be writing graphics routines in Scheme or in Prolog. You're going to use that language that's really, really fast when it makes a difference to do it. All right, historically, what are some languages you should know? Fortran was the first high-level programming language. I do lots of asterisks. I'll do the error asterisks on things. You have to be really careful saying something like that. Most people agree it was the first sort of general-purpose, publicly used language out there. There were a few companies that had sort of research projects that had little languages they were developing in-house for their own use, never made it sort of outside, that you could sort of say were the first high-level languages. But in terms of something that anybody could get their hands on and use, and it was public and stuff like that, Fortran was the first. Developed at IBM, completed in 1957, and again, designed for a particular machine. So it wasn't originally designed to be a general purpose language anybody could use except for those machines. It eventually, people saw it, said, wow, this is great. Can you make it, give me a compiler for this machine? Can you give me a compiler for this machine? And so they took that same language, but it was designed with the IBM 704 in mind, which is why some of the instructions are a little bit weird, because they actually match very closely what 704 machine instructions did. In particular, one of the weird things in Fortran, you didn't have if statements that said, if this is true, do this. You had if statements that looked like this. If X, 10, 20, 30. That's what an if statement looked like. And what it would basically do is evaluate this expression. And if the expression was negative, it would jump to a location that was labeled 10. If it was 0, it would jump to a location labeled 20. If it was positive, it would jump to a location labeled 30. Now, it can do what an if statement, if else, does. But it's not the way we think of a logical if-else. Why did they do it this way? Well, that was a machine instruction that would, so you go through the CPU, and if you get this value and the result is negative, it would branch to this location. There's basically, because there was a one-to-one mapping between this and a machine instruction for the IBM 704. So this is actually Fortran. This is Hello World. I should keep showing you Hello Worlds and things. That's a Fortran. Fortran was really interesting. Fortran was my first language that I learned. I learned Fortran on punch cards because I am old. It was old at the time I learned it. But
how did you do it on punch cards? It's got text. I didn't think the punch cards had text. Or did you like punch out letters?
Oh, it was. In fact, I should bring some punch cards. Can you envision what a punch card is? It's a little piece of cardboard, and basically it had letters on it. So when you were programmed, you would go to a punch card machine. So it was basically like a big typewriter, which you don't even know what typewriters are, but it was a big machine. It was like you'd walk up to it. You didn't even sit or whatever. And you would feed a card into it, and then you would type the command you want, and it punched holes in the card to match those letters. So essentially, each line in here is, you can think about sort of the card was something like here, and there would be sort of 26, well, more than that. You'd have all these sort of spots here, and when you hit the letter A, it would go and it would punch out the little hole there that corresponded to an A.
So we would have a column of all the possible characters?
Yeah.
Could...
And there weren't a lot. So, like, for example, at the time here, this is, this is probably not, early Fortrans, you didn't have both lowercase and uppercase. So you only had uppercase because you didn't want to have to store, you didn't want to have twice as many holes for the letters on there. So the first Fortran was all uppercase. And so you would actually go and you'd type in the thing, and the one I was working on at that point was fairly modern. So you had actually a little screen in there. When you typed it, you could see the letters, so it would be exactly what you want. So if you had a typo, you could back up and do it. And then it would look like you wanted to, you'd hit a button, and it would punch it out on the card, and the card would come out. And then you would take that and you'd put it in your deck. And then you'd type in the next line of your instruction, you'd put it there. Perish the thought if you ever like dropped your deck and all the cards got mixed up. So one of the things you did is when you wrote them, you would write on the back what number it was. So if they ever got mixed up. It also meant though, what was kind of cool is that if you wrote a program and that did whatever, and then the next program you say, I want to reuse some of those things, that you could just go and grab the cards and stick them in the other one. So you had code reuse in terms of physically moving cards, whatever. But where I learned it, at least, I was at a small college actually in Alabama. I went my first year. So you would go and you'd type in your program like that. You would put a big rubber band around it. You would go to a window. You didn't actually touch a computer. You would go to a window and you would put your deck of cards into a little slot there. And then maybe an hour later you'd come back and there would be a printout with your deck that says here was the output of your program. So they would take them all, they would feed them all in together into a computer, they'd wait till they had enough of them, they would batch them all together, and they would feed it into the big computer, and then you'd see this printout with the little accordion paper whatever. And you get back a thing saying, you know, syntax error on card 27. And so you waited an hour to figure out that you had a typo, and then you'd have to go back. So you didn't have typos, right? You went through your code and make sure everything made sense. It's not like today when I see, you know, 221 students where it doesn't work and it's just like, well, let's just try moving this line here and see if that fixes it, right? You've never done that, right? You know, I've got, I'm short a curly brace. Okay, let's just put one here. Let's put one at the end. Let's see if that's where it should go. I see that all the time. It's like, why would you think that putting it at the end is always going to be the right thing? So one of the things that was sort of lost nowadays is because it's so easy to run code and debug it, is that people don't think as much about their code as we had to back then. Right? Saying, "All right, my day, we had to." I would not go back to these days. These are bad. One of the things interesting about this in Fortran, the columns meant something because in punch cards, so if you had a C in the first column, that meant it was a comment, so it would ignore the rest of it. Notice here that there's sort of a space over here. There were, I think, 2 through 8 was where you put labels. So this is line 10, and so I can say, "Do go to this line," or whatever here, and then columns 9 through whatever is actual code that you were doing. Mm-hmm. So where you put things in the columns actually meant something. You couldn't put end over here, because those were the columns that were reserved for labels on things. So it was kind of a interesting thing that there's physical properties to the code as well as sort of logical properties on stuff. But so Fortran came out. We're going to talk about Fortran quite a bit as we're doing language things. And again, we have to be very kind to the developers of Fortran because they had no idea what they were doing. And they had to figure these things out. And so they made some mistakes that just seem ludicrous by today's standards. But nobody had ever thought about this stuff before. I told you guys the story about in Fortran you could say 5 is equal to 4 and actually change the value of 5. Because they hadn't really thought about the idea that you can only put a variable on the left-hand side because the left-hand side variable is a very different thing from the right-hand side variable. The right-hand side is talking about the value of the variable. The left-hand side is talking about the address of the variable. And so eventually they came out with these terms. There's something called the R value and the L value of a variable. When it's on the left-hand side, you're really talking about its address. When it's on the right-hand side, you're talking about its value. And this will come up in Java. I think you still can get this error message. If you did this in Java, you'd get an error message that says L value expected. I mean, who the heck knows what that means if you don't have a little bit of context to know, variables have L values and R values. What appears on the left-hand side has to be an L value. It has to be something associated with an address. And so that error message now makes sense. If you ever get that message, you'll know what it means. Fortran has evolved. There's still tons of Fortran code out there. People write Fortran. Fortran has evolved a lot. I mean, you can do object-oriented stuff in Fortran now, which is a weird thing. It's not like people really do that. I mean, Fortran really is more around now for there's so much legacy code out there. So there's a lot of engineering code, scientific code that's still out there in Fortran that people still maintain and develop and do things with. But Fortran was the pioneer on stuff. There were some other languages that came out very quickly after Fortran. Lisp is the sort of precursor to Scheme that we're going to use. So Lisp was the first functional language. It came out a couple years after Fortran, so it was really the second language. And it was developed because at the time, some of the biggest projects with computers were doing things we call artificial intelligence. So there was a lot with natural language understanding, so we wanted to be able to listen in on the Russian communications and be able to translate it and figure out what they were doing. We wanted to do vision so that we could sort of see things, and we wanted robots, and we wanted computers that could play chess and all these different things, because people thought that it was going to be really easy to do all this stuff. And it turns out all those things I described are really hard, that we're still trying to figure a lot of them out. Chess is actually one that we've pretty much licked, but other things. And for all these types of tasks, Fortran is horrible. Fortran is a really sort of rigid, structured language. It's all about numbers. It stands for formula translation. It was for engineers and mathematicians to be able to basically enter in algebraic expressions and solve them. It's not for telling you that the robot is in this room and there's an obstacle this far in front of it, and on top of the obstacle is a box, and that box is this color. And it's like, how do you represent all these things in numbers? You can, but it's just not good for that. And it's not very good for lots of changes. So in AI, there's very often where things, all of a sudden you move something around, and then the number of things on this box, this table changes, and this stuff changes over here. Fortran was really locked in terms of when you created an array, the compile time, you had to say this array is going to store 100 things. And it sets 100 things, and that's always going to be there. There's no way of growing it. There's no way of shrinking it, anything like that. So Lisp was designed to be a really flexible, dynamic language. It basically, the Lisp type that's in Python, that's the growable list and shrinkable and all this kind of stuff, is basically invented in Lisp for doing things. Incredibly inefficient because, again, it didn't match the von Neumann architecture. It wasn't about variables and assignments. In fact, there in Lisp, there was no variables, no assignments, no loops. It was all done with transformations and recursion. That's just not what the von Neumann architecture is built for. So it was a slower language, but it was very flexible. And so all the AI research, even to this day, is largely done in functional languages. There's just such a huge code base out there and things. Nowadays, when you talk about Lisp, there's really two sort of modern versions. There's Scheme that we're going to use, which is kind of a very small, clean version of Lisp that evolved. And then Common Lisp is the sort of the massive, every possible library you could ever want version of Lisp. I like to sort of always say when we talk about it, there are a bunch of different Lisps that evolved at different places. Scheme was the intersection of all those Lisps. Common Lisp was the union of all those Lisps. So every feature that anybody thought was useful, they put into Common Lisp. In Scheme, they said, if anybody didn't think this feature was useful, we're not going to put it in. And so you have very different sort of philosophies for what those languages came out with. Some other key ones in the 1960s. So Fortran had come out and was getting really big. There were people that were not comfortable with the fact that it was an IBM property. So every computer was getting Fortran compilers, and Fortran was taking over the world. And some people weren't comfortable with that, especially non-US people were not very happy about the US sort of taking over computers. So there was an international effort to develop a universal language that everybody could use, that it wouldn't be tied to IBM, it wouldn't be about them making money and developing things for their purposes or whatever. So ALGOL was short for the algorithmic language. Very interesting historical thing. What languages do you guys know? You guys know Python? You know Java? What else?
JavaScript. PHP.
PHP. JavaScript is the one that's kind of on the border. All of those languages were really developed by one person. Not the same person, but they were the brainchild and the product of one person. Almost all languages these days are like that. And even when you took a JavaScript was, developed at Netscape at the time, but it was really one guy that was kind of behind it and was the intellectual force behind it. This is an overgeneralization. It's not always the case. But pretty much nowadays, the best languages are the brainchild of a single person or a small group of people. Designing a language by committee, have you ever done sort of things by committees? Committees sometimes can just get really bogged down and really all this kind of stuff. ALGO was the perfect example of a language designed by a committee. And not only a committee, but really two committees, because it was an international effort. So there were sort of the American contingent who felt like they should control things because, hey, we invented Fortran and we know what we're doing. You had the sort of the European, the international group, the German sort of equivalent of the ACM that was involved. And man, they just butted heads all the time. Like, for example, what number is that?
1,000.
Not if you're from Europe. That's 1.0. Mm-hmm. Right? In Europe, they use the comma where we use a decimal place. They use a decimal place where we use a comma. Right. And they just fought and fought over this, right? It's like the wall for them. And there were all these things where they sort of culturally they didn't meet, and it's like, okay, how do we do it? And they did all these weird compromises where it said basically there's dialects of it. There's the European dialect and the American dialect. And you kind of have to say which one it is, and the American one, dots mean decimal points, and the European, like, what? So that means you're like your program you wrote in the US, you tried to take to Germany and run it, it wouldn't work right because you'd have to translate from one dialect to another. It was an amazing language in that right now, pretty much every language we deal with descends from Algol, but no one ever used this language because it was such a nightmare. But they developed sort of all of the ideas and all of the features that everybody picked on. It's okay, that's great. I'm taking that and putting it into my language. It's just, it was such a god-awful nightmare of a language because of all the compromise they made that you couldn't really use it the way it was in Algol. And they tried at different points. It was Algol 68 was like a pretty good attempt to try and make this better. But it's still, I mean, basically Algol 68 turned into Pascal, which was a very successful language in the 70s. And Pascal turned into C, which turned into C++, which turned into Java, which turned into JavaScript to some extent. So all of these things, if you're typing in Java, you're typing in Python, you're typing in what's called a Python, an Algol-like language, or an Algol family language. It was a language that introduced the idea of a data type. You know, you could create, you have data types that you could use and specifically identify those. Compound statements, the idea of a begin-end or curly braces, didn't have that in Fortran. The natural control structure, if-else, for, while, those were developed for Algol. Different types of parameter passing. Fortran just had one way of doing it. It had multiple ways. Recursion, you couldn't do recursion in Fortran. And we'll see why when we talk about how it did memory management stuff. It also was where Bacchus Naur form was introduced, which is what we're going to use again to talk about syntax on things. So all these things came out of the development of this language that were pretty much adopted by every other language after the fact. So it was the pioneer, it was the one that did all of the theoretical work. It just wasn't really useful as a language by itself, but everybody stole all the good ideas and used them in their own languages. It must have been really frustrating to work on this and not get any of the credit. I mean, they got credit for doing it, but nobody used your language. Even, again, one of the weird things on here, the bold in here, that's important. So when you published Algol code, you had to list the keywords in bold. Okay, that was one of the rules of the language. It's like, that's weird. It's weird stuff. Okay. So Algol influenced everything that came afterwards, including sort of Pascal, which was, again, the dominant language of the 70s. C came out in the late early 70s. Again, it's sort of the new model, I think the way I think of most languages, most successful languages today. It was written by one person. It wasn't intended to be a general purpose language. It just, he did such a good job that everybody said, hey, I want to use that. I want to do that. And then it just sort of grew on things. So Dennis Ritchie was at Bell Labs. He was developing a new operating system. He wanted to write Unix, which you guys have all heard Unix. If you don't know Unix, if you have a Mac, you're running Unix. So underneath, if you go to the terminal, and get a terminal window, that's a Unix that's running there. So all the Mac stuff is sitting on top of Unix for doing stuff. So we wanted to write an operating system, and the trouble is the languages at the time were just not really good for writing operating systems. You'd want to write it in a machine language, because that's a nightmare. But you're not going to do an operating system in Fortran. You're not going to do it in Lisp, something like that. What do you use to write an operating system? You want the high-level language features of loops and things that are very natural, variables, loops, ifs, all that kind of stuff. But you also have to get at the hardware of the machine. You've got to get at the guts of this memory address and this buffer and all this kind of stuff and connect to drivers and all this stuff. And so what he said is, well, I'm going to write my own language that has high-level abstractions plus low-level constructs, the ability to get at the hardware of the machine underneath it. And so he wrote C. And when Unix took off, C was the language you used to write code for Unix. And so everybody that adopted Unix learned C. And even people that weren't doing Unix, C was like, oh, that's a pretty good language. I'm going to learn that. And it really took off. Interestingly enough, it was written by him for, I think it was not until the late 80s that it was standardized. So there was no body that sort of said, these are the rules for C. Ritchie and Kernahan Ritchie, yeah, wrote a book, and that was the Bible for C. So Kernahan and Ritchie was where if you ever had a question on C, you just went to their book, and it told you what C was supposed to do. But there was never anybody that sort of mandated that. You could write your own C compiler, and if it didn't do something right, who was going to stop you? I mean, it was all sort of public stuff on things. In the mid-80s, Bjarne Stroustrup, what a great name. You don't have to do it now, but just when you go back to on your own, just say Bjarne Stroustrup a few times. It's fun. It's a fun thing to do. He basically took C and added object orientation to it and became C++. And it sort of created the first big wave. There were other languages out there. Smalltalk is where he stole a lot of the object stuff from it. They're out there. But C++ is really what made object orientation take over the world. Java then evolved, was developed at Sun. There were some people there, Bill Joy, and really, I think it was blanking who the other guy was that was really big in the development of Java. It really comes down to it, Java is just a cleaned up C++. It's just sort of the modern one. For a reason we're going to talk about, C++ had to keep backward compatibility with C, so all the ugly things you don't really want somebody to do that were provided in C because it was for writing operating systems had to be in C++, and so it was a really dangerous language, and then Java just said, okay, we're going to take all those things you don't really need, and it cleaned up the language quite a bit. And then in some ways, JavaScript has kind of evolved out of Java. It's a completely different language. But it took a lot of the same, you know, for loops and if statements, everything looked the same in all four of those languages. So the basic structures are really the same across all of those. So actually there's Hello World in all four languages. And you can see they look pretty much alike. I mean, for loops are really the same thing. Except you don't have to give a type in JavaScript. But those are all from really the same family as you do stuff. Now, there's a lot of other languages out there. COBOL was, again, one of the early languages developed in 1960 for doing business applications. It's the wordiest language you'll ever see. So it was designed for business people to be doing payroll and accounting and all this kind of stuff. And so it reads very much like English to a large extent. And so COBOL code's really wordy, but it also reads very easily on stuff. BASIC was in 1964. It was a language for beginners. I still get people who sometimes see BASIC in high school. Anybody see? Done some BASIC? No, it's a really simple language on doing stuff. Simula in 1967 was really the first language that brought classes in. They were kind of not sort of fully classes, we think about them now, but the whole idea of being able to create your own type by putting data and operations together came from Simula. Pascal in 1971 was really sort of the successful successor to Algol. It was a very much, I think he was actually going to call it Algol something, and then decided, now I'll just give it a brand new name, named after Blaise Pascal. Prolog is a language very near and dear to my heart. That's what I did my PhD research with. It's a logic programming language. It's very cool. It's very... you guys are going to fight me a little bit on Scheme because it's very different from the way you think about things. You would fight me like the Dickens on Prolog because it's a completely different way of thinking. Scheme kind of makes a little bit more sense, so you're not going to fight quite as hard. I think the first couple of years I came to Creighton, I tried doing Prolog and basically realized that it would take me an entire semester to teach you Prolog and we wouldn't be doing any of the other stuff. It's just that the curve is just so much on there. But it's a very cool language. And then some more modern ones, Ada. Still there's people out there that love Ada. In the 1980s, it was the official government language. So if you did anything for the Department of Defense, you were required to write in Ada. Okay. But it didn't actually happen. Because there was so much code out there already written in other languages that if you were a developer, you could apply and say, well, look, I already have this code base of all this stuff written in C++. It would cost $10 million for me to port it all into Ada. Do you want me to do that? And they go, yeah, we'll give you a waiver. And you could do it in C++. There's people out there, I still know people. Ada is, I think, is a lovely language. It's just a very pure, it's a wonderful language. There are people out there that just, I think, were broken by the fact that it never made it. They're like, it's so much better. It does this so much better than Java or whatever like that. It should have won. It didn't. Get over it. But there's people that still sort of cry away to do stuff. Okay, last one, then we'll do syntax next time. We'll do the Google. Key thing I sort of mentioned last time, remember, there is no single best language. And it often comes down to what community are you writing for? What types of tasks do you want to do? Do you care about efficiency? Do you care about whatever? And so what has happened is that within different communities, there are languages that have become sort of the standards. It doesn't mean you couldn't use other languages in those communities, and it doesn't mean other languages aren't sort of encroaching. But if you think, if you're writing code for business applications, you may still be doing COBOL. Although, that's actually probably one that's changed a lot. There's probably a lot of scripting languages that have really cut into that. If you're doing artificial intelligence, you're probably doing Scheme or Common Lisp. Maybe Prolog if you're European. If you're doing systems programming, you're writing C. Maybe it's wrapped in C++ or whatever. Software engineering, you're using some object-oriented language, C++ or C# or Java or Smalltalk. There's still some people doing Smalltalk. If you're doing web development, you're probably doing JavaScript for front-end. You're doing PHP or Ruby or Kotlin or something, or Go for back-end types of things. So there are a lot of different sort of application areas. There's a lot of different languages that fit into those niches. But it's also very dynamic, that some languages sort of move around. Python is actually snuck into a lot of these categories. It's used in a lot of different places nowadays. And then certainly, you know, something like Java is a big hammer. You can use it in a lot of places. You don't always need that much strength. But it's not like you couldn't do, you know, systems programming certainly in Java, because it sort of sits on top of C++. You could do it artificial intelligence Java. It's just going to be more work as you do stuff. Okay? All right, so that's sort of our background stuff. Next time we're going to do is look at syntax. We'll probably get through the rest of this. This goes pretty quickly. But we're going to look at how do you define in a really concrete, unambiguous way what an if statement looks like, what an assignment looks like, what are the forms that a variable name can take. So in Java, for example, what can variable names look like?
They can start with a letter and include a number, but it can't start with a number. Am I doing it right?
Yeah, you're doing great, because everything you said was true, but I'm guessing if you just said that, and then I said to everybody, okay, we're doing a test now on what's legal or not, everyone would have different interpretations of what that meant.
Right.
So that's just not a very clean way. We could try and say it very cleanly. We can condense it down, but it's still going to be open to some ambiguities. Mm-hmm. So for example, you can have underscores.
Right.
Can you start with an underscore?
Yes.
Can you start with a letter?
Yes.
Can you start with a digit?
No.
Okay. So the cleanest way I can say it in English is in Java, variable is made up of digits, underscores, and letters, but can't start with a digit. But even that, I bet you somebody misinterprets that. Okay. And that's just not very clear. We need a clean way of saying it that everybody can agree, this is a valid variable name, this is not.
Right.
And that's what syntax rules are going to do for us. Okay. Cool.